Here's our presentation. Karen Allen is going to be doing it. She works at Utah State University, and she not only knows about the science of food production, but she also knows about the laws and regulations and issues that small businesses face in developing a food product. And she also has a little bit of a culinary background, and so she can bring a variety of things together. And so she's really, we're fortunate to have her here at Utah State University. And she's put together a lot of great information here. And so I will just, with that, turn it over to Karen Allen and let her begin her presentation.
All right. Thank you, Ruby. Good morning. This is Karen Allen. I'm the Food Quality and Entrepreneurship Specialist at Utah State University through our Extension Services. And today I'm going to be talking about food safety and product labeling, specifically those issues that come up with small businesses. When we look at a lot of producers, they're really looking at how to increase the value of an agricultural commodity, extend a shelf life or a harvest season, for example. One of the ways we can do that is through food processing. Value-added foods technically includes anything that is a specialty type of market, for example, local, organic, vine-ripened, specialty types of crops, heirloom tomatoes, for example. It also includes gourmet foods. This would be more the processed category, jams and jellies, any type of pickled commodity, hot sauces, oil and vinegar. The issue with these processed foods is that you do have to meet safety and labeling requirements of whatever agency you're working with for the certification of your production facility. Oops, I hit the wrong button. There we go. So I'm going to start off talking about the food safety aspects. When we think about food safety, we do have a few options as far as where that food product can be produced. One of the best options as far as the safety and the regulatory issues go is to use a contract packager or a co-packer. These are certified food production facilities. They have already registered, jumped through all the hoops with the FDA. During their downtime, they can produce your product for you. This involves providing them with your specific recipe or formulation. Some of these co-packers do not actually have a product of their own, but are just in the business of processing other businesses' recipes. Others do have their own line of products. The problem with some of these things is it can be very difficult to find a co-packer that is both cost-effective for you as a small business, and also they may have very strange schedules as far as when their downtime occurs to allow you to have your product processed. The plus side to these is there are no limitations on where you can sell your product. It can be marketed directly to restaurants. You can sell it directly to a grocery store or through a larger wholesaler or a distributor. Also, you don't have to worry about maintaining that registration through the appropriate governing agency. Another option, and this is the one that we see a lot of times, is very common, and in fact there's a lot of interest in these types of facilities, are commercial kitchens. These are typically not certified at the federal level, but are certified by a state or local health department. For example, this includes incubator kitchens, restaurant kitchens, school cafeterias. All of these types of facilities can be used to produce your product. The nice thing here, again, you can sell to restaurants, you can go directly to a grocery store, you can go through any type of distributor or wholesaler, and you can control your own production rate. It's not quite as specific to when a facility is going to have downtime. Usually these are available a lot of times on evenings and weekends, and there are many incubator kitchens where there is no standard production that's going on. It's just a series of entrepreneurs or small businesses who are coming in and contracting for a block of time to use that establishment. The problem here is that space is difficult to find. There are several resources I've noticed in this last 8 to 10 months. More and more industry groups or extension services are trying to come up with lists of incubator kitchens available throughout the country. One place that I was just recently approached by to list our incubator kitchen here at Utah State University is the National Association for the Specialty Food Trade. They are in the process of developing an online directory of incubator kitchens throughout the country. That specific resource as of February 2013 is not online yet, but it is something that they are working on, and within the next couple of months I would expect to see that available. Another option in many states is to produce the food in your own personal home kitchen. These rules are typically referred to as cottage rules. These kitchens, in the majority of the cases, are certified by a state agency, for example, the State Department of Agriculture. The regulations vary significantly depending on the state that you are in. The pro to this, it's less expensive than renting space in a commercial kitchen or trying to contract to have a co-packer produce your product. The problem with this, though, is that only very limited types of foods can be prepared, those that we typically consider to be non-hazardous, and we'll talk a little more about that later in this presentation. Also, the limitations on where you can sell your product are much stricter. Typically, you cannot sell directly to a restaurant. You cannot have that home-produced product go through any type of distributor or warehouse. Some states are even so restrictive to say that the only place you can sell home-produced foods it would be, for example, at a farmer's market, at a bake sale, something that was more of a craft fair or event as opposed to an established grocery store. Currently in the West, here's a list of the states that do allow home food production. There is information on this slide. There are the websites listed. I understand that there is also a sheet that has been put together with direct links to all of this information. As you can see, Nevada and Idaho are the two main states that really have been hesitant to enact any type of cottage food production. I was told that Montana, in some cases, does allow home food production, but I have been unable to find that information on their website. Sometimes it's easy to find. For example, New Mexico has a wonderful program put together. It's very easy to find that information. Some others you really have to dig. Regardless of where you're going to make your product, you do have to consider certain food safety issues. You need to consider how are you going to clean and sanitize both your work surfaces and your equipment and tools. How are you going to prepare or cook your product so that you don't introduce any safety risks? How are you going to package that product to prevent any additional contamination? Also, how are you going to package it to extend its shelf life and keep it fresh and appealing to the consumer? And then how will you store and display your product? So I want to go over a couple of important definitions. When we talk from a food safety standpoint about clean, we're talking about surfaces or foods that are free of visible dirt or debris. This would be, you know, obviously a spoon that has food stuck to it would not be clean. When we talk about sanitary, we're talking about surfaces or equipment that is free of disease-causing bacteria or pathogenic bacteria. This applies to processed foods and contact surfaces. The issue here is spoilage bacteria are still present. For example, things like mold spores can also be there. So we do need to look at the shelf life issues, even though we are working under sanitary conditions. When we talk about sterile, it's free of all viable bacteria. There is really no such thing as sterile in a food setting. Commercial sterility for food is considered to be 99.99% free of any bacteria. What this means is even at our best commercial canneries, one can out of 10,000 is assumed to contain viable bacteria, even with those more advanced processing techniques and more strict handling. So for kitchen sanitation, and this would apply whether you're working in a home kitchen or whether you're working in a rented kitchen, make sure that you sanitize your equipment and surfaces at the start of production, especially in a shared space. You don't know how adequately the person who was there before you cleaned those surfaces. So it's always good practice to assume that it's dirty. Go in, sanitize at the beginning of production. Currently, FDA regulations allow chlorine use up to 200 parts per million. This is the equivalent of approximately 1 tablespoon of unscented household bleach per 1 gallon of water. This is considered safe for food contact surfaces. Anything higher than 200 parts per million would be considered an additive, and you would need to follow different FDA regulations. As long as you are in that 100 to 200 parts per million range, you're going to be good. There are a lot of different types of test strips that you can purchase. These are available at restaurant supply stores, on many online sites, and they typically run between $5 and $7 for one of those little tubes that you see on the picture there on the side. The most common one that you will find at restaurant supply stores are the chlorine test strips, which is the appropriate type to use if you're using bleach. If you are working in an incubator kitchen or in a restaurant, they may have other types of sanitizers available. That could include quaternary ammonium compounds or iodine-based compounds. There are test strips available for both of those types of sanitizers. And if you are using one of those, make sure that you're following the manufacturer instructions as to the strength, the concentration that you mix that solution. As you are working, it's important to wipe up spills immediately. Don't leave food debris on the counters. If it is something that there is any question if it may be introducing bacteria into your product or your workspace, sanitize that area after you have cleaned it. It's also recommended that you check or refresh your sanitizer every hour. Just grab another test strip, dunk it in. It's just a quick color reading. You compare it to the little tube. There's a color guide on that tube. If it looks like your sanitizing solution is weakening, dump it out and make up a fresh batch. Then, as a courtesy to everyone else who's going to be using the kitchen, clean and sanitize all equipment and surfaces at the end of production. Make sure that you leave that facility, whether it's your home kitchen or a shared space, as clean as you would like it to be when you come in. In commercial kitchens, there will be a 3-compartment sink available. 3-compartment sinks are great. They're actually divided into several different steps. The first step is there will be a scraping and pre-rinsing station. The next step in that is the actual 3-compartment sink. You have 1 compartment for washing your tools, another for rinsing, and then a third for sanitizing. The important part here is that you allow those tools and equipment to air dry after they have been sanitized. If you are working from a home kitchen, it's actually very easy to set up a system that you can use that mimics that 3-compartment sink First, scrape or wipe into a garbage can. Use paper towels. Don't use cloth rags. Then you can wash and rinse in your kitchen sink and sanitize in a separate tub. Find a food-grade tub and just fill that with your sanitizing solution and allow your dishes to soak in that. After that, make sure again that you allow them to air dry. And the sanitizing solution in that tub should be the same concentration as the sanitizing solution that you are using to wash off your equipment and your food contact surfaces. The next thing we need to look at is how we can limit bacterial growth. One very important scientific principle, and this is the basis for a lot of the foods that have been approved through the various cottage rules, bacteria have to have water available to multiply. A lack of water will not necessarily kill the bacteria, but it will prevent them from growing. So we judge this by the water activity, or AW, of the product. Water activity is very easily confused with moisture content. Moisture content is a measure of how much water is actually present in a food product. Water activity is a measure of how much of that water is available for bacteria to grow. So, for example, if you have a syrup, in that case, you have added sugar to lower that water activity. So even though there is a larger amount of water present, it is chemically tied up by that sugar, and it is not available to the bacteria. Other examples of places where we can add sugar or salt is also very effective at lowering water activity, things like jellies, candies like fudge, a lot of dressings rely on the salt content. We can also remove water to lower the water activity, and this would apply to dried fruits and jerky. The majority of the cottage food rules do not allow for home producers to dry things like fruits in their own home kitchen. And anything containing meat, for example, jerkies, would be regulated by the USDA, and it is required that that is made in a USDA-certified facility. This is just a list of some examples of different foods and the typical water activity range that we see. Kind of the guideline that we look at in most cases is a water activity of 0.85. So you can see even things like syrup, fruit juice, high sugar cakes are kind of on a borderline where they may be just above that 0.85. Anything below that, the jams and marmalades, soy sauce, caramels, crackers, anything below that 0.85 is something that we would consider from a food safety standpoint to be a very low risk or non-hazardous type of food product. The other way we can limit bacterial growth is through the acidity or the pH of the product. This is especially important to control Clostridium botulinum. This is the bacteria that is responsible for botulism poisoning. When we add sufficient acid to a product, we will limit the growth of Clostridium botulinum. Clostridium is a spore-forming bacteria that is present basically everywhere. These spores of Clostridium botulinum can be found just in dirt, on the bottom of your shoes. The problem here is if they get into a package where there is no oxygen present, so this is especially important in canning, those spores can actually wake up and become viable growing bacteria. Clostridium, because it is so, there's so many issues with that poison that it produces as it grows, this is really a concern. By having a pH of 4.6 or lower, we can prevent that spore from waking up. So the spore will still be present. We're not destroying it, but we're preventing those live growing bacteria from being there. Naturally acidic foods, things like jams and jellies, fruits, all of those types of things can be canned without certification through the Food and Drug Administration. When you are canning low acid foods, so for example, canned green beans or anything that is considered acidified, you do have to be certified through the FDA to engage in those activities. Examples of acidified products are most salsas. We also have things like vinegar and oil that fall under this same category. So these things are very tightly regulated. When we look at pH, this is just a chart where you can see most of our food products actually fall between 7, which is a neutral pH, and 3, which is an acidic pH. Now, when we're looking at a pH of 4.6, you can see right on that line, tomatoes. So when we're using tomato products, it's very iffy if that product is actually going to be a low enough pH to allow for safe and proper canning. So here are a few food safety resources just for your information. The FDA Food Code is the piece of legislation and guidance that is directed more towards restaurants and food service facilities. But if you are following the food code in your home kitchen as closely as you can, you're going to be producing foods safely. That's available at the FDA website. Also, contact your state extension services. Many extension services do have a food safety specialist on their campuses. And if you cannot find resources through your state or online, please feel free to send me an email, contact me, and I will put you in touch with the appropriate individual or agency.
Do you want to take a few questions now, Karen?
Sure.
All right. One was, through cottage food rolls, can you sell your products online?
Most of these cottage food rules, the one clear factor in all of these cottage food rules is that they can only be sold within the state that they are produced. So if you are ensuring that your online sales are only to people within your state, you should be okay. Now, you would need to verify with your specific state that there aren't stricter limitations on those places where you can sell those products. For example, as I mentioned, there are places, for example, Wyoming, you can only sell them at a farmer's market or through, you know, a bake sale or some type of craft fair or something where you're selling those products. So in those cases, the best advice I could give you would be to contact the State Department of Agriculture or the health department that regulates cottage food production in your state and verify with them that that would be an acceptable outlet for your product.
Another, it's not a question, but just a comment, I guess, from the audience, is that they said that Alabama allows acidic canned foods and baked goods to be sold at farmers markets.
Yeah, and I don't have information on the cottage food rules throughout the entire country. I did just kind of focus on the West. And that seems to be a very common theme, is that any type of acid food that is canned, so if you're canning fruits, if you're canning jams and jellies, those types of things, there's very few regulations on. Also, most baked goods we know, just from a historical standpoint, were able to be produced safely because of the baking step, any bacteria that's there is typically destroyed. So that's a very common theme that we see with most of these cottage food laws in most of the states, is that those types of products can be sold.
Okay. Are there value-added products that do not need to be produced in a non-certified kitchen?
Value-added products that do not need to be... I'm not sure that I understand. Is that cannot be produced in a non...
No, they're saying that, are there any food products or value-added ag products that do not need to be produced in a non-certified kitchen? So can you do anything outside of a certified kitchen?
Anything outside of a certified kitchen, yeah. And that's where we get into some other issues. If your kitchen is located on a farm, you fall under a whole different set of rules than the cottage food rules. There are a lot of agricultural commodities that can be processed to a certain degree, as long as that processing is taking place in a facility co-located on a farm without having to go through additional certifications. But that would be a very specific type of situation. As far as just producers out of your own kitchen, if you are not growing that product, the most common things that we see through these cottage rules are, for example, the foods under a water activity of 0.85, so jams, jellies, some syrups, and then baked goods and candies.
Okay. Karen's going to go on and do a part on packaging and the labeling and stuff, but we've got a few more questions on the food safety part. How long is your sanitation solution viable? For instance, if you were, if you were using it to sanitize bottles for beverages, how many times could you use the solution to sanitize those bottles?
Okay. So, sanitation, when you're looking at these solutions, especially with chlorine, the way it works is it is a very potent oxidizer. That's a very specific class of chemical. Now, you can probably tell just by the name oxidizer that there's oxygen involved in this whole process. The longer you leave that sanitizing solution sitting out exposed to air, the more that chemical is actually going to react with oxygen at the very surface of that solution, and you're losing your sanitizing power. Also, anytime it comes in contact with organic material, so that's any food, it's going to oxidize that and destroy that in addition to the bacteria. But what happens as a result is you lose sanitizing power. So that is why it's always recommended that you check that sanitizing solution. For example, to sanitize bottles, if you rinse out one set of bottles with sanitizing solution and you're not sure if it's still okay to use again, check the sanitizing solution with a test strip. If you are still within that acceptable concentration range, and I would say for sanitizing bottles, you would want to be above 100 parts per million. You would want to be between 100 and 200. Sanitize the next set of bottles, and then check it again just to be sure.
Okay. You mentioned that vinegars have a potential for botulism. California is currently allowing vinegar to be approved for cottage food processing. What are your thoughts on this? Do you feel it's potentially hazardous?
Okay, so when I mentioned vinegar, it was in combination with oil. Certain vinegar and oil combinations have the potential to be hazardous. When you are talking about a vinegar, a straight vinegar, or a flavored vinegar where you are adding different herbs or spices, those are not hazardous. Vinegar has a very low pH and would effectively prevent any botulism spores from waking back up, from becoming vegetative.
Okay, and I've got one more question. You indicated school kitchens can be used. How many school kitchens are partnering with value-added producers, and what are the traditional arrangements?
As far as I know, in the state of Utah, there are no school kitchens that are partnering with producers. This is something that I see as having huge potential. In a lot of states, I know they're looking at cutting back on those programs that were traditionally fell into the home economics or family and consumer science areas. And when we look at these foods classes and these foods labs, they sit unused for a large part of the year. So in a school kitchen, that could be approved. But there are not very many places that I am aware of, and in fact, none in Utah. I don't know about some of the other states, but that's something that has huge potential. And for those extension educators out there, that's something that would make a great project to get that going, to work with some of those school districts and partner to allow that to occur, especially in more rural areas.
All right. I think that was the end of the questions there. And so I think we can go on to the product labeling. Karen's going to resume her presentation.
Just one comment on cottage food production while we're waiting for this presentation to come back up. There is a current proposed rule that was put out in January by the Food and Drug Administration, that may affect how the Food Safety Modernization Act affects different cottage rules. But in this proposed rule from the FDA, they have very specifically said that they will not require home kitchens, private residences, to register with the FDA, and that they will not regulate any product that is sold within the state that it is produced or within a 275-mile radius. Now, this has not been enacted yet, but that is what they are proposing. So that's a very good sign as far as these home food production rules go. So let's talk about the statement of identity. As far as labeling goes, most of these cottage food rules do require that you have some specific labeling issues, so or elements. On the previous slide, the primary display panel, you do need to have a statement of identity, and you do need to have a net weight statement. And this is true for any product, whether you're producing it through a co-packer, in a commercial kitchen, or in your home kitchen. So what the statement of identity is a legally established name that is required to be used. And this is in the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 21, which is the Food and Drug Administration portion. If you want to look that up, you can find that online, but I have listed here the different categories of foods that have a required statement of identity. If your food that you're producing does not fall into one of these categories, you can use a common or usual name, as long as it is not misleading the consumer as to what's in that food package. The other requirements, if, for example, if you're canning something and you cannot see it through the package, you have to say what that form of food is. So if you are slicing apples and canning them in an opaque container or in metal, you would need to say that they are sliced apples or apple rings. If you are producing any type of fruit juice, or any type of beverage where you have a picture of fruit or vegetables on the label, which implies that it contains juice from those fruits or vegetables, you are required underneath that statement of identity to say the percentage of juice that it actually contains. The next requirement, the required label components, these are all on the information panel. This would be the panel immediately to the right of that primary display panel. So on a can or a round jar, it would be just to the right of it. On a box, it would be over on that next side. There you will find the nutrition facts panel, the ingredient statement, and the producer name and address. The ingredient statement is required for all food products, and you do need to list the ingredients in order by weight descending. If you are adding any type of preservative, for example, if you're putting ascorbic acid into a product to keep it from browning, then you would need to specify that that is its function. Spices, natural flavors, artificial flavors, these can all be grouped together with the exception of any spice or product that is typically considered a vegetable or coming from a vegetable. So if you have onion or garlic or celery, if you're using powders or salts or minced product, you do need to specify those by name. Also, you need to specify salt and MSG by name. One thing that is not required but is encouraged is to specifically list any mustard product that you have in there, because there are a small percentage of the population that do have sensitivities to mustard. If you're using any types of certified colors, and typically this isn't such an issue in home production, unless you are using some type of food coloring, you will need to list the specific certified color that is in that food coloring. This information can be found on the box that the food coloring was purchased in. As part of the ingredient statement, you should have an allergen statement. There are two ways that you can do this. You can incorporate those allergens into your ingredient statement by saying specifically, for example, enriched wheat flour, milk, cheese, you know, making sure that you are very clearly pointing out those allergens. The other option that you have is putting a statement underneath the ingredient statement and saying that it contains milk, eggs, soy, for example. So the major allergens are wheat, milk, eggs, soy, fish, and shellfish, and, tree nuts and peanuts. Those are the major allergens that you are required to list. So let's move on to the nutrition facts panel. This is an image of the requirements from the FDA for the font. So just by looking at that and thinking if there are that many regulations on just the style of the nutrition facts panel, there are many, many more as far as the content that goes into it. It really is one of the most involved and specific set of regulations in the food code. If you choose to have a nutrition facts panel, you have to base your serving size on the reference amount customarily consumed, or the RAC. There is a RAC table in the Code of Federal Regulations that lists the majority of the different types of food products and what the required serving size is. So a lot of times when you pick up a food package and say, why are they saying there's 2.5 servings in this bottle of Coke? It's because that is the way the FDA has defined a serving. This is something that there's been a lot of interest in revising, but I think that legislation is probably several years off because the FDA has quite a bit on their plate as far as getting the regulations required through the Food Safety Modernization Act in place. There is a small business exemption. You are not required to have a nutrition facts panel. If you do direct-to-consumer sales of $50,000 or less annually, this would include anything you sell at farmers markets, from a roadside stand. If you are have an arrangement with a shop or boutique where you are putting your product into that store, but you are managing the sale of it, those types of things we typically put under that umbrella of direct-to-consumer sales. If you are doing any type of sales through any warehouse or distribution channels, this rule does not apply. In that case, you would look at how many employees you have. So processors with fewer than 100 employees also do not have to have that nutrition facts panel. If you are required to register with the FDA in your facility, then you would have to file for an exemption to not have to include that nutrition facts panel. Now, the one exception to this is that no nutrition-related claims can be made. If you say, high in protein, good source of carbohydrates, anything like that, you have to have a nutrition facts panel to back those statements up. So the types of health claims that we sometimes see, there are approved health claims. These are specific statements like products high in oat fiber have been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. These are specific statements where there's a general scientific consensus and the FDA has approved those health claims. They can be used as long as your product meets the requirements. There are also qualified health claims where there's some evidence, but we haven't really reached consensus in the scientific community as to whether this has a clear health benefit. The FDA will give conditional approval, but the wording for these qualified health claims becomes so convoluted and so confusing that most companies don't even use these. The one place we do see them typically, though, is in supplements. You do have to use the specific wording, as I mentioned, and that is in the Code of Federal Regulations, and I have listed that portion there where you can see those specific claims. So the nutrient content claims. There are content claims. This would be something like free, fat-free, low sugar. There are relative claims where it's based on compared to a normal product. This is a low sugar candy or added vitamin C. And then other types of claims, you can see anything we're saying excellent source of, contains this much iron, lean, or any type of fiber claims. If you have any information like this on your label, you would be required to have a nutrition facts panel. So here are some resources where you can get information on labeling. The FDA has put out a short document. It's only 80 pages long, as opposed to two volumes worth of labeling regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations. But it is the Guidance for Industry, a food labeling guide. And you can search food labeling guide at FDA.gov and find that as a PDF document. State governments, especially if you are working through the cottage food rule, any state government that has a cottage food regulation will be able to give you assistance on how you need to label that specifically. The majority of the rules that I've looked through. You are required to have the statement of identity, the net weight. You're required to have the ingredients and the place, your business name and the place of production. But as far as the nutrition facts panel, it varies. So always double check with your state government, typically the Department of Agriculture. And also, if you have any questions that you cannot find answers to, again, please feel free to contact me and I will get any information to you that I can.
Great. I think we've got some time for a few questions from the audience. I'm going to start out with some that came in. Does the 50,000 level for the exemption include direct sales of unprocessed produce?
No. This would only be processed foods. So if they are on a farm, for example, and they're selling both unprocessed and processed foods, the unprocessed foods are regulated separately. The FDA has said very clearly they are not going to include raw agricultural commodities in calculating sales levels or those types of things for farms that are involved in both types of activities.
All right. Another question. I have used Patricia A. Curtis' Guide to Food Law and Regulations. It was published in 2005 in the past. Do you have a more recent book slash publication summarizing food laws? It also covers labeling.
Yes. Anything that's more than a year or two old is outdated. So if you look, there is the Food and Drug Law Institute. You can look up that organization online. And they have a book that was just put out this year. It's a practical guide to FDA's food and drug law and regulation. And it's the fourth edition is the most current one. This one covers all aspects of products that are regulated by the FDA. So it does include cosmetics, tobacco, and pharmaceuticals. But the nice thing about this is it was put together by lawyers who specialize in food and drug law, and they have done a very good job of putting that legalese into terms that most of us can understand.
Okay. Are there any geographical restrictions to where homemade products can be marketed? Can they be sold outside of your county or state?
And that's something, you know, that the FDA, as I mentioned, has just stepped in this proposed rule and said that they will not regulate products or they will not require registration and record keeping that they would through the Food Safety and Modernization Act for most facilities. They won't require the same level of record keeping. They won't really interfere as long as those products do not enter interstate commerce and as long as you have documentation that you are complying with some other health regulation. So, for example, on the state or local level, they have even gone so far as to say they can be sold out of state within a 275-mile radius. So that's, and as I mentioned, this has not been enacted yet, but that is their proposed rule. So it looks like that's the direction they're going, which is wonderful, wonderful news.
Okay. Another question, what about organic and country of origin labeling?
Okay, so for organic labeling, that is regulated through the USDA. There are some very specific requirements as far as can you use the term organic, can you use a certifying agency seal. The good thing about this for most small-scale producers is that typically your State Department of Agriculture does a lot of the inspections for the USDA on a contractual basis. So most states have a program put together where they have they follow the USDA guidelines for organic certification, but you will be dealing with a state inspector, and you can also often use a state seal, an organic seal. I would recommend for that that you contact your State Department of Agriculture and look at what their fee schedule is, what exactly is set up within your state. If you have a product that is grown organically, that can be marketed as organic as long as you have gone through that certification process. When you're looking at producing a processed food, you do need to consider the percentage of organic ingredients, and they will also need to come inspect your processing facility to see how you are handling and separating organic ingredients from any non-organic ingredients.
All right. And then another question was, can we write down the name of that FDA book?
Yes. And, you know, what I will do is I will forward that name and see if they can add that to the list of the links from the slides in this presentation.
Okay. So I think that that is all for Karen's presentation. I think she did a good job.